The Down in a Heap podcast from Rob C. is one of the only podcasts that I can stand to listen to. I'm Froth from the Thought Eater podcast, and I approve this message.
In old school games, life is cheap. Don't be a dope. Bring your pole on the rope and try not to go down in a heap.
We're gonna win, Twins. We're going to score. We're going to win, Twins. Watch that baseball soar. Knock out a home run. Shout a hip hooray. Cheer for the Minnesota Twins today. Yeah, it's super hokey. But I am pretty happy about the Twins throwing King Kong off their back and winning an actual playoff game. Not only that, they won the opening wild card series and are now sitting 1-1 against the Houston Astros in the divisional series. And they play later this afternoon back at home here at Target Field. So, yeah, I'm pretty whipped up about baseball right now. And that, along with other things, is kind of distracting me from doing a whole lot with OSR October. So I apologize for that. And hopefully next week I'm supposed to be on vacation next week. We'll see what happens because I've got a brand new person who's my assistant, and she knows virtually nothing about cheese. She's doing pretty good so far as picking up on some of the technical things we do, you know, just cutting and wrapping and things like that. But actually demonstrating much knowledge about cheese, she's still very much a neophyte. And, you know, whether or not I'm actually able to take a week off is kind of up in the air. Anyway, if I do get a week off, I hope to spend a lot more time doing some actual podcasting and stuff. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. So today, I did get a big box of goodies from the latest Kickstarter that Jeff Jones over at RPG Ramblings, his last Kickstarter for the new Gary's Appendix, that arrived. So I've got to look through that for some new OSR goodies here. I've got Gary's Appendix issue 2, issue 3, and then a couple adventures. Fane of the Fly God and what's the other one called? The Black Crag or something like that. Anyway, they look on just paging through them, they look pretty cool. So I'll at least take a look at some of those things for OSR October. And I've got a little house cleaning to do too. I have some messages in my back catalog. Well, no, not back catalog. That's not the right word for it. I've got some messages that I had from before OSR October, and I've only gotten one so far in related to the episodes here in October. So one from Jason, of course. It's kind of disappointing how the changes that Spotify made to Anchor have kind of, for me at least, really taken away from the advantages that Anchor used to have. It used to be almost, I thought of podcasts almost as a way, a video or an audio blog, and it was an easy, and the messages that people had and the replies to them were almost like the comment sections and blogs. So it was to me a more personal avenue to have with other people than blogging, just because I do think that hearing someone else's voice and the intonations they have and being able to pick up on the fact that they're tongue-in-cheek or trying to be funny or something is something that sometimes can be lost in the written word or misinterpreted more easily in the written word. So I kind of thought of the podcasters, especially our little what used to be called the OSR Anchorites, had this kind of tight community. And the messaging function for Anchor was so easy to be able to send messages to the other podcasts and to upload them onto yours and reply. It was far and away to me the best feature about Anchor. The only thing that rivaled it was just the ease of use. So Spotify's torpedoed that. So now, I mean, you can send messages, but it's become a much more involved process. And I frankly don't hear, I don't get as many messages. I don't send messages very often any longer. And on many of the other podcasts I listen to, there aren't nearly as many messages there as there used to be. So thanks, Spotify. You've ruined the best features of the app that you acquired. So congratulations on that. So without further ado, let's answer some of the messages that people were kind enough to jump through hoops to send me here. And of course, my usual MO, I forgot to thank Froth from the Thought Eater podcast, Thought Eater blog, for his ringing endorsement of my podcast, and to Joe Richter for sending his version of my theme song to me. So thanks, guys.
Hey there, John here from the Red Dice Diaries. Just listening to your Placement of Treasure in BX episode, and I've got to agree with yourself and Joe. I prefer running campaigns, although I'm no stranger to one-shots, and I tend to use them as palate cleansers either between longer campaigns or as a break when we need a bit of a change. They're also great for proof of concept stuff, you know, when you come with a concept that might work for a campaign, but you're not sure. Sometimes running a few one-shots set in that campaign world can let you know if the players like the new idea and if it's really got legs. Anyway, just wanted to drop a quick call. Very much enjoyed the episode. Keep up the good work, dude, and I'll catch you soon.
Hey, thanks so much for the message, John. I appreciate it. And I've been listening to Red Dice Diaries here, well, for a long time, but recently it seems like John's been dropping some more episodes lately, and they're all worth checking out, so go check it out. And words of wisdom there from John. There can certainly be value in one-shots. I mean, aside from just the enjoyment you have gaming, right? Test driving some new systems, and the idea of a palate cleanser or something. I also think of it as a fill-in kind of game. If you have a group of six people that play and two or three of them can't make it, well, maybe you roll out something and play some kind of espionage thriller with just two players and a referee or something without having a session that might be disruptive to the campaign at large if you somehow have to come up with a reason why half the adventuring party isn't present or something. I don't know. But yeah, for the most part, I much prefer campaign play, but there's definitely places where a one-shot can work out great. And if it's face-to-face, I'd still probably rather play a board game as a palate cleanser or just a one-off kind of thing. But, you know, a lot of people actually prefer role-playing games to board games, so that's totally cool. And now we'll move on to a trio of calls from Rich Frazier over at Cockatrice Nuggets. Take it away, Rich.
It's about time you showed up.
Hey, Rob, it's Rich. So I got one thing specifically from your treasure reading podcast. Encumbrance is optional in BX? What the hell? That seems like, I don't know, that seems like antithetical to the whole, like, system. Like, encumbrance is core to that system. It's all about finding treasure and how you get that treasure out. If you don't have encumbrance, you're just bagging that stuff up and dragging it around. Anyway, on the subject of treasure, do you think 5th edition does treasure better? Instead of all these random treasure types that don't make sense unless you, like, delve into them and try and figure them out specifically for each one, 5e just has 1 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 15, 15 to 20, and average treasure for what a monster would carry or a horde. What do you think about that? Let me know.
Hey, Rich, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yes, encumbrance in BX is listed as an optional rule, as is damage by weapon type, morale, and the alternate initiative system that they call paired combat, which is a little bit like a, not exactly individual initiative, but something more akin to that than side initiative. Anyway, I do like that approach that BX had, and that a lot of like board games or war games have, where they have optional rules that are typically something to explore a little bit more simulation in a game. They often add more complexity to a game, but also, in my mind, often add a more enriching experience. And encumbrance definitely falls along that line when you're, as you point out, having a game where treasure is the primary motivator for the players, the primary, excuse me, geez, I'm still fighting this frog in my throat. The primary motivator and the primary way that that characters acquire experience points, having some kind of regulator limiting how much treasure they can like pull out of the dungeon at one time, and having this this drawback of having a big swag bag, you know, limiting reducing your movement rate and stuff, I think adds a lot to the game. That said, much of my gaming has pretty much hand-waved encumbrance, and it's only from time to time that we try and pull the players, often kicking and screaming. Well, that's exaggerating, but they usually don't like tracking that kind of stuff into the game. And it's a whole, that whole give and take as far as how much simulation adds to the game for some people, but becomes a headache for others that have a different point of view on what's fun in a game and stuff. So it's, yeah, I mean, a lot of these things to me, while they're listed as optional rules, like I would never play a game of D&D anymore without some kind of morale system. I think it's imperative to capture the kind of feel I want in the game to have that. Likewise, I would be very opposed to playing a game that just used the same weapon damage for every type of weapon, unless there was also factors that that made up for that in some way, like you had bonuses to hit with some weapons, or penalties to hit with other weapons, or something to make the choice matter, what you chose, you know? But yeah, that's true, they're optional rules. As far as whether or not I think the 5e system for allocating treasure is better than what's presented in BX or AD&D, it's hard for me to say because I don't have the DM's guide or monster manual anymore from 5e. So I'm just going off of what you said and what I remember from running 5e, whatever it was, 8 years ago now when I ran it for almost 2 years, I think. And at that point, I don't think I was even really using any of the rules, if they have them, for allocating treasure in my games. If anything, I was leaning more back on my old games for determining that. Now, it sounds like what you're saying is there's two types. There's like incidental and horde, and it's based upon strictly the tiers of play that you have in 5e. So 1st to 5th, 6th to 10th, 11th to 15th, and 16 plus, or whatever it is. No, I don't. I think to me, the way they do treasure in 5e is inferior to the way the old games do it. Primarily because it has nothing to do with your character advancing other than being able to purchase better equipment and become more capable thereby, or by acquiring magic items that help you overcome foes, because rules as written, the only thing that really gives you experience points is defeating monsters. So I think that's an inferior way to play for me and my group. I prefer hunting for treasure as the primary motivator, not killing monsters. And then as far as just the placement of treasure, no, I mean, even though the treasure type system in old games is a little bit cryptic, there is some kind of horse sense to it. You can have some monsters that are more prone to gathering and hoarding treasure and giving them more, like, say, a dragon, or dwarves, or some undead that have a better chance for, a large burial accompaniment or something, you know? Rather than just arbitrarily basing it upon the CR rating of a monster, just because they're tougher, they have more treasure. To me, it makes more sense from a game world point of view that some monsters value treasure more than others and are more prone to have larger hordes because of it. So, yeah, I prefer the old method of doing it. That said, I am going off my faulty memory and just the cursory knowledge that you presented to from the 5e point of view. So I'm doing it from a little bit of a ignorant point of view. All right, on to your other messages.
Okay, let's talk about traps. So I use traps sparingly. When I do, I broadcast them there. There is a burned up husk of a body sitting in front of three holes in the wall with black marks everywhere. I tell people that the trap is there, and the puzzle or the trap component is getting around the trap without setting it off. My favorite trap is the stupidest thing in the world. It's a double pit trap. The first pit trap is open. The second pit trap is closed. So they walk up, they see, oh, it's a pit trap. And then they jump over it and there's a second pit trap right after it. If they would have taken a minute and explored it, then they would have figured it out. I think traps as puzzles are much better than traps as, gotcha, you're dead. That's what I think, and I don't use puzzles, so that's it. Actually, that's not true. I do use puzzles, but I don't put anything behind them. A puzzle is going to have some sort of bonus, some sort of odd thing, some sort of item granted, right? You fix the fountain, and the fountain gives you hit points back. Or you unlock the statue, and the statue releases the sword in its hand, and it's an exceptional sword, or something like that. I am of the school. I believe that puzzles shouldn't have things locked behind them. I lock my door with a lock, not a puzzle. Actually, that's not true. I have one of those keypads on my door, so if you guess the number that I put in there, then you can get into my house. So I guess my house is locked with a puzzle.
Yeah, I'm of a similar mind. I don't use traps very often, and I hardly ever use puzzles, too. And riddles, maybe that third leg of the, well, I suppose it's tricks, but riddles especially I don't use. I'm a little reluctant to use all three, in part because what seems easy to solve or difficult to solve when you're designing an adventure or something often becomes the exact opposite for your players. They figure out the riddle you thought was a difficult riddle very easily, or what you think is a super easy riddle. None of them have any idea whatsoever. And traps are kind of the same way. And I usually do a lot of broadcasting, foreshadowing of traps as well. I'll have the occasional gotcha trap, but for the most part, the players have some kind of sense of danger. And really, I mean, going into a dungeon or some kind of tomb or something like that, they're usually already a little bit cautious. The key is you don't want so many traps that it just slows down the pace of play to a snail, snail's pace, because they're so cautious. They're tapping every surface with a 10-foot pole. They're just crawling along, you know, with their thief checking for traps or their dwarf checking for traps at every opportunity. And of course you can combat that by the resource management tools that are in like a BX game or something, the wandering monsters, the light sources dwindling, food, time itself, slipping away from them and stuff. So there are ways to mitigate that, and that's kind of a balancing act, and I get that. But all that said, I think traps, for the most part, are a downer. So, I don't use them very often. I'm running a pre-written dungeon right now in my Planet Eris game that the party's going through. And there was one trap in there that has some foreshadowing. It's not a super obvious thing, but it probably, and I think it did, give the players pause, but not pause enough, because it's something that just like disintegrates someone if they fail their saving throw. And there were all these skulls around this pillar of skulls, but the pillar of skulls had gems in the eye sockets of the skulls. And of course the skulls piled around them did not have gems, and they had to try and get the gems out. And they were Brian's character, his fighter named a Took, who also happens to have jeweler as his previous skill or whatever. He was kind of trying to pry those gems out, and I was just having a roll each time to see not only if he was successful in prying it out without doing any damage to the gems, but if he was doing it in a way that he wasn't setting off this trap, that he wasn't touching the actual statue and stuff. And he got through almost all of them, but then failed his last check, and he failed his save, and a Took was disintegrated except for his skull. And that, you know, that's pretty harsh. Now the gems that they acquired from doing that were very valuable. So there is kind of a risk reward situation set up there, and they got the reward at the expense of a Took. Had another coughing fit, so I'm gonna have to wrap up this podcast. There was all the elements of player agency were there, right? They had the choice of trying to get the gems out. They definitely felt like what they were doing was potentially dangerous. They had a sense that this could be some kind of trap. I don't think any of them, however, were thinking we might get disintegrated. So I felt a little bit, very slight pang of regret when Brian failed the saving throw for a Took. But, you know, he was a second level character. It's not like it was a huge setback or something. But there was some foreshadowing. It wasn't just like the old poison needle trap or something where, yeah, when you're examining a treasure chest or opening it, players almost always are cautious and stuff. But still, the old completely out of the blue gotcha trap, I tend to frown at. Well, I don't use them. If your group has fun with them, that's cool, whatever. But especially when the players don't really have any chance or any reason to search for those traps when it's essentially a bolt from the blue and someone's just unlucky and you're like, all right, save or die here. This huge slab of stone deadfall falls from the ceiling and, you know, squishes you unless you can make a save versus petrification to jump out of the way. Otherwise you're dead. Yeah. Those types of things I'm usually not super into. I think they tend to be the types of things that make the players just feel kind of, yeah, my character didn't really have a chance. It was just all luck. And not much player skill. So I think traps should involve player skill. I think they should involve agency and all that. So I think we're pretty much on the same page. And now one last call here from Jason from Nerds RPG Variety Cast.
Hey Rob, Jason here. Great opening to OSR October for 2023. We've already communicated and you know, I'm wishing the best for Mary, and that's kind of miserable, but I'm glad you're following the doctor's advice and you're under good care. As far as blue cheese dressing soda, I love blue cheese dressing. I really do. I would not have bought that. You're a braver man than I am. I'm glad it didn't turn out utterly horrible, but yeah, I don't know. But, you know, now you have to, you mentioned it. So now you have to buy the spaghetti and meatball soda and tell us what that tastes like. If I need to PayPal you some money, I will. You're right about the new shiny and chasing these games and all that. There's no question about any of that. And yeah, as far as definitions, there's no reason to get in these definitions wars, because ultimately, and I have a guest on later in the month where we kind of touch on this at the end of the episode, but you really nailed it here right at the beginning of the month. The key is these games are cross-compatible. And so you go out, you know, don't be a one-brand man, right? You're not just going to buy OSC and only OSC compatible games. You can buy any of these things and pick and choose and borrow things and hack them together or run modules and interchange them or plug these modules in with your own campaign world. And that's always been the beauty of the OSR, is the sharing and the camaraderie between all the different people and the ability to hack and plug all this stuff together. So it's great to hear you back on the air, my friend. I look forward to talking to you soon and can't wait to see what you do next. Take care.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for the well wishes and the message. I appreciate it. And I agree wholeheartedly. I think the cross-compatibility with all these different games, different designers, different creators is perhaps the strongest suit of the OSR. So you can utilize all these different creative endeavors, add them to your game or spice up your game with various little components to tweak things, to dial it into the preferences you have. Because we do share this OSR language, this common set of rules, and to a lesser degree, a similar outlook in play style. But, of course, it's not lockstep, and that's the other thing that makes it interesting, right? It's not just a monolithic kind of presentation. It's a similar kind of thing, much like Gary's game of Greyhawk was different from Dave's game of Blackmoor, but they were both recognizable to each other. So yeah, I agree with that, and I'll load up on some more of those novelty sodas and subject myself to some more. Well, the blue cheese dressing one was all anticipation. There was nothing to it. It was a big nothing burger. It was a blue cream soda, basically. So we'll see if the other ones are any different. And I got to run to work. And until I talk to you again, thanks for listening. Thanks to Rich and John and Jason for those messages. And until I talk to you again, don't go down in a heap.